What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
It's a strange shift, isn't it? The parent who raised you needs some help, and you want to be there. With Care.com, you don't have to do it alone. Whether you're clear on the kind of care your aging loved one needs or still figuring it out, we've got support. Find background-checked in-home senior caregivers for anything from companionship to dementia care, or browse senior living communities, read reviews, even schedule a tour, plus access to safety checks to help with your peace of mind. Still not sure what's best? Our senior care advisors, who are all master's level social workers, can help you build a plan. For a limited time, use the code LISTEN20 for 20% off your initial care.com subscription. That's LISTEN20, all one word, good for 20% off. Start your senior care journey with confidence.
Hello, welcome to the Katie Halper Show. This is a not so typical episode of the show. This is a very, I guess, sensitive episode, time sensitive, and also sensitive episode because it's with Erica Garner. She's the daughter of Eric Garner, who was murdered by the NYPD. And I interviewed her a couple weeks ago. I was going to release it shortly, but there's some really sad news, which is that she's in the hospital. She suffered a heart attack and is in a medically induced coma. I interviewed Erica twice, once the first week of December and once the week after. She had approached me because she wanted to talk about the 3-year anniversary of the non-indictment of her father's killer on December 3rd, 2017. And of course, Eric Garner was the unarmed black man who said, "I can't breathe," 11 times after he was placed in a chokehold by a police officer on Staten Island. The NYPD were not indicted, let alone convicted. So I want to take this opportunity to release the episode because what Erica talks about is so important to Erica, and it's an issue that she spends her life fighting for. And Erica Garner has dedicated her life to honoring her father's memory and also to organizing against police brutality and impunity. And I think it's really important and moving. And she says some really harsh things about de Blasio that are pretty deserved, I'd say. And she also has some really great insights into organizing and how people can honor her father's memory and impact the lives of others. I'm not including an intro and outro with me and Gabe. We're not obviously charging for any bonus content or anything. And if people want to keep up with what's happening with Erica, someone who works with Erica has taken over her Twitter account and has been tweeting about her. You can follow her Twitter. That's ES_Snipes. ES_Snipes. So this is the first interview that we did over the phone. Also, at certain points in the interview, you will hear a baby in the background because, as Erica explained, she has a 3-month-old son named Eric, the third. What are some things that you want people to know about your father, his life, anything really, whether it's personal or political? What are some of the things that you wish people knew?
He was the type of guy, he was a family man. He did everything that he could to take care of his 6 kids. He never really had any type of altercation. He was like a gentle giant. Like, he loved his neighborhood, he loved his family. If he sees you in need, he'll do his best to help you. I remember a homeless guy, you know, he was like really upset that my father was gone because my father would buy him sandwiches every day, or in the wintertime, get him a coat or some sneakers if he needed it, some socks. So my father was like, you know, he was like my hero, you know, and nothing can replace him.
And you have your own daughter?
Yes. Actually, I just had a son not too long ago. He's about 3 months.
Oh, congrats.
I have an 8-year-old daughter, and Eric, I named my son Eric III after my father.
And you have a brother named Eric?
Yes.
Okay. What's your daughter's name?
Her name is Alyssa.
And so she got to meet her, she knew her grandfather, right?
My daughter's father is not really in her life, but my father stepped in as that male role model. So she was in love. Like me, I'm the oldest daughter from my father. I was always the apple of his eye, and then my daughter is the first granddaughter. So all that love transferred to my daughter.
And so does she have memories of your father?
Yeah, she talks about, you know, how he taught her to cross the street and, like, little things. But as she gets older, I think, you know, some of the memories is fading away. She was only going on 5 when he passed.
So he taught her how to cross the street, like, looking at traffic, making sure you don't get hit?
Looking at traffic and looking at this red stop sign, I mean, this red hand and the walking guy on the stop sign. You know, little things. My father was also a math genius. So, you know, he was very good with numbers. So he would help her with her homework.
Oh, nice.
Stuff like that.
Was police brutality and criminal justice reform, were those things that you thought about before?
It was talked about, but not really a main idea for me or a main push for me. I always been curious about the criminal justice system. I always did like little research as hobby, but never really engaged in it as I am now.
You live in New York and there are black men in your family. Is that something that you, before this happened, did you live in fear of something like this happening to one of your relatives or loved ones?
Not necessarily. It wasn't something that was brought to light. You know, we heard stories of other black men being killed, but it never hit home as close as it did when it happened to my dad. Yeah, my father always had encounters with the police. He was very adamant on, especially towards the end of his life, that, you know, he was being harassed. And, you know, he was being basically backed into a corner, you know, from police officers on Staten Island, locking him up, taking his cigarettes, taking his money, money being tied up in bail, him doing time in jail even, just for, you know, something so small as, you know, selling cigarettes.
How do you learn about what had happened?
At the time, I was working in Long Island City at a Dunkin' Donuts, and my sister had called me in a frantic and told me, you know, she don't know what happened, but oh, she's hearing that my father stopped breathing. It was the middle of the summer, so I figured, you know, maybe it's an asthma attack. Maybe he's on his way to the hospital. But my mom wasn't answering the phone. No one's answered the phone. So it was a while before we actually found out what actually happened. We just had, the family was just notified that, you know, he just stopped breathing. It was nothing about the police or what had happened. And then, you know, later on that night, a person from Daily News told me there was a video of someone that witnessed. So actually that night, me and my brothers and sisters, we sat around the computer and we seen the brutal video of my father being murdered.
Hold on.
Don't touch me.
Damn.
And what was that like?
It was heartbreaking. It was very shocking. I remember feeling dizzy, nauseous, having sweats. It was something that you couldn't describe. As we re-entered the living room with the rest of the family, we couldn't even describe. We just broke down and started crying.
And that was the footage shot by
Ramsey Order. He actually knew my father from being out there. So he just pulled out his camera. He didn't know, you know, how it would end, but he knew, I don't know, just to take out the camera.
Once again, police beating up on people.
Back up
right here.
Back up, then get on that step.
Okay.
Back up.
Back up this way. Everybody now back up. It's now going to become a crisis.
Back up.
Back it up. Back it up.
I'm going to my house.
This way. Let's go.
Can't go in my house?
In the house or that way?
All right, I call it that way.
Pick a choice.
I'm getting my bike.
You had your chance to get your bike, sir. Staying over there right now. We haven't seen.
And then he's been harassed by the police.
Yes. After the incident and everything started to come out, he was harassed. Like, cops used to come by his mom's house and flash lights through his door. They actually raided his house and said that he had drugs when he really didn't. He also described being arrested by the same group of cops who actually murdered my father. And they pulled out cameras and said, well, you recorded us. We're going to record you now.
Right. Jesus. Your father, before being murdered, he had helped break up a fight.
Yes. In the book of with Matt Taibbi, I worked with him. He's actually spoke with people that was there that day. I never lived on Staten Island. I'm from Brooklyn. Yeah. But a lot of people that day said that, you know, he was breaking up a fight. Like, he didn't even have cigarettes that day.
The fight breaker, I stopped. Yes. Don't say you can put it up on me.
That's all right.
The people that's fighting is to walk away. Are you serious? I didn't do nothing. What did I do?
Then before
what the fuck am I doing? Take me back for what? I didn't sell anything. I did nothing. We sitting here the whole time, out of our business. What are you talking about? Who watched you do what? Who did I sell cigarettes to?
This guy right here is forcibly trying to lock somebody
everybody
up for breaking up a fight.
Everybody standing here, they told you I didn't do nothing. I did not sell nothing.
All he did was break up a fight. And this is what happens for breaking up a fight. It's crazy.
But also, I want people to know that there was a message. If you look at the video, my father was basically pleading before he said, I can't breathe. He was basically pleading with the officers to leave him alone.
Right.
That they didn't have, you know, no reason to bother him.
These are your hard way for what? Every time you see me, you want to mess with me. I'm tired of it. It stops today. Every time you see me, you want to harass me. You want to stop me until I'm so sick of it. I'm minding my business, officer. I'm minding my business. Please just leave me alone. I told you the last time. Please just leave me alone.
He was just, you know, out there hanging out with what he usually does. With his friends, and my father is like the peacemaker, so he just wanted, you know, nothing to really, you know, stir up for cops to come. So he was trying to, you know, make peace between the two people that was fighting.
One of the things that was so troubling, I remember when I saw the video and read about it, was that it wasn't just what they did to him, but it was how they left him.
Yes, the EMT also failed to administer CPR. Also, in another video that I've seen, they was talking to him like he was alive. Mm. Like he was just, you know, playing while his dead body was laying there. And what they did after, you know, everything that has occurred, like, you know, the false statement, the way they handled his body after, like, I was told that the coroner is supposed to move a dead body,
mm-hmm.
but they just threw his body on a gurney like a piece of meat.
And then he was lying down the sidewalk for 7 minutes while the ambulance came. And none of the officers there did anything to try to resuscitate him. And then, of course, their excuse is that he was still breathing. So you don't give CPR to someone who's still breathing.
Yeah. And it's heartbreaking to know that, you know, here you have a lifeless body and no one tried to, you know, help him.
The ambulance arrived and two EMTs inside the ambulance did not administer any emergency medical aid. He had a heart attack on the way to the Richmond University Medical Center.
Yeah, that's what the police says. all the EMT says, but I believe that he died on that sidewalk. Mm. Because in part of the video, you can see his body shaking. Maybe he had a seizure or a heart attack or something. But it's very heartbreaking to even talk about it and replay what I've seen. I've seen the video over like a thousand times. And, right. You know, it's something that I viewed like as a case study because I wanted to know every aspect of what happened that day.
Can you tell us what you are up to right now?
Right now, I'm in the process of starting a 501c3 C4 foundation. It's a nonprofit and for profit. Basically, I want to focus on organizing, endorsing candidates to spread the message about the movement, and also having panels to discuss this topic about police brutality and the policies, and also, you know, hopefully one day starting programs within the school to just keep our youth engaged, and maybe starting, you know, independent podcasts and just news outlets to get the word out there.
Something that I've noticed a lot about your writing and your tweets is that, and your speaking, is that you really don't see police brutality as kind of an isolated phenomenon. You make the connection between police brutality and, as you just said, education. Can you talk about the connections between police brutality and other issues?
Yes, because as you know, that my dad was killed by the NYPD officer, and you know, I've been working tirelessly to, you know, from protesting to talk to people in Congress, state senators, and trying to look up the laws. And the connection between police brutality and its policies and education, like, a lot of people don't know, you know, what is the right steps to go about pursuing justice. So, like, in school, we're not educated on this, and, you know, it's very limited on resources to go about these issues.
Can you talk about what you were doing in terms of organizing and activism, if any at all, before the murder of your father? Did you have experience as an activist and organizer before what happened to your father? Or was your father's murder the thing that really turned you into?
Yeah, it's something that happened basically overnight. I didn't have no idea of what I was doing, but I connected with the right people, and, you know, I just went from there. I started out by protesting small little gatherings outside of a mail office, of a postal office, and then I gradually graduated from that to doing weekly protests where the spot that my father was actually murdered to the police station. And then I done traveled to different various cities and states to talk about this issue with local communities and elected officials.
And can you talk about some of the things that you did, like the die-in that you did?
Yeah, I mean, that was the first time that I actually went viral. Mm-hmm. I did a die-in. I've seen a lot of people around the world doing die-ins, like priests, you know, other activists from different countries, you know, showing solidarity. And I felt like I had to go to the spot and lay in that spot to send a message, basically, that, you know, I wanted to feel something, like, I don't know how to describe it, but it was a very emotional thing for me to actually be in that spot and lay in the same spot that he died in. Mm-hmm.
And so was that, and how many times did you did that, how many times did that turn into a...
It turned into like an annual thing, like every Tuesday and Thursday for like about a year.
Yeah.
The first year that everything happened.
How did that feel for you?
It brought a lot of attention. a lot of people started reaching out. That's when I started traveling and speaking to other activists and other organizations and speaking on panels and talking to state senators and people in general to, you know, support my cause.
In 2014, hundreds of congressional staffers walked off their jobs in Washington, D.C. to show support for your family and also the family of Michael Brown. Had you coordinated this with them, or did they do that on their own?
They did that on their own, but, you know, I appreciated that. I felt very good that a lot of people were paying attention, and actually for people in Congress to leave the floor in solidarity with my family, and meant a lot.
Were you surprised that de Blasio didn't do more or hasn't done more?
In the beginning, he seemed like he was very supportive. For the first 2 years, he stood with Reverend Al Sharpton, who has been, I guess, an advisor for my family. He stood with him in support of, you know, change in policies, retraining, and body cameras and whatnot. But this year for the anniversary, he refused to even speak my father's name. Mm. He also stood with police officers to open up a new police station out in Staten Island on the day that my father was killed.
Wow.
So I feel like Bill de Blasio is pandering to police. The police officers of New York turned their backs on him not only once but twice. I believe that, you know, he's not doing much. During his first term, he lobbied and promised us in New York is that stop and frisk will be, you know, come to an end, but it's just been reformed into the broken windows policy. It was basically the same thing, and which also led to my father being killed that day. The broken windows is basically, as Bill Bratton described it, if the police don't do nothing about a broken window in a neighborhood, it can lead to bigger crimes. So basically, it's arresting minorities for minor crimes like an open container or staying in a park after dusk.
Right. So things that aren't really public threats or don't endanger people, but things that, of course, can fulfill police quotas.
Yes.
Right. What would you like people to do? What actions would you like people to take?
Just right now, I feel like a lot of people are focused on Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the message somehow got lost.
Mm.
And I would like people to regroup, reorganize, and re-strategize.
Can you also talk about which organizations you think are doing good work on this issue?
The Black Organizing Project, Black Youth Organizing Project, Dream Defenders. But there's a lot of Black organizing organizations out there that, you know, I would like to connect with.
And this is the second interview that I did with Eric over the phone a week later. You had emailed me a couple of the things that you wanted to talk about because it was the third anniversary of the non-indictment of the man who killed your father. And the things that you said you wanted to highlight were that Mayor Bill de Blasio has failed to fire Dan Pantaleo in order to pander to police. And I'm quoting you here, that de Blasio obstructs the passing of the Right to Know Act, that de Blasio refuses to make the chokehold illegal, that de Blasio refuses to release the records of Daniel Pantaleo in spite of the recommendation of the CCRB, which is the Civilian Complaint Review Board, that Governor Cuomo's special prosecutor mandate was temporary and he has not renewed it, nor has he lobbied Albany to make it permanent, and that the Department of Justice promised to bring resolution to the status of the civil rights portion by the end of the year. Can we go through these things and talk about them?
Mm-hmm.
De Blasio has failed to fire Daniel Pantaleo, and you see that as pandering to the police.
Yes. He refuses to punish the officers who killed my father, especially Daniel Pantaleo. He says that he's waiting for the federal government to conclude their investigation before he makes a decision. But I just think that he's just holding off to satisfy police officers. The man stood with my family for the past 3 years. you know, on the anniversary, he was at the church in Staten Island. That's when he famously said, you know, all lives matter. My dad's life mattered. But, you know, here we are 3 years later. On the third anniversary this year of my father's death, he stood with officers, refused to mention my dad's name, but he opened up a new police station on Staten Island. This year was the first year that he hasn't mentioned my dad's name at all.
Wow.
And I was just thinking maybe it's because re-election was right around the corner.
Right. And were you surprised that happened?
I was upset. I reached out to, I think, Channel 7. And, you know, I expressed how I felt about that. And his response was basically, you know, he can't do or say anything to help my pain. But it's plenty of things he can do, such as, you know, the recommendation from the CCRB or the Right to Know Act or many other things that he hasn't done.
Bill de Blasio has obviously served one term, and he's going to serve a second term. Do you have any hopes that maybe he will do more about your father's case and about police brutality in general, given that he won't be up for re-election?
Like, I'm hoping that he'll hear my cries and the city cries about having better relations with the police officers and not being afraid to die when we encounter these officers. But to me, I believe that it's going to be more of the same.
And what about people who say, oh, what can he do, just to play devil's advocate? Oh, well, he doesn't have a choice. What's he supposed to do? NYPD turned their backs on him at officers' funerals. What's your response to that?
My response is he's supposed to be our mayor. Like, it shouldn't be just because police officers are turning their backs on him or he's afraid of losing police officers' support or whatever. You know, if anyone should know what to do or know what the right thing to do should be him, a man of a black child, you know, who has ties of a black family.
Do you think he hides behind that sometimes, like the fact that he's married to a black woman and has two black children?
I believe he does, because, you know, he ran his first campaign about, you know, basically exploiting his son with the afro and his wife being black. And I think he just used that as a pawn to get elected. I believe that he really doesn't care about black lives, even though he has a black family.
It's sometimes, in some ways, it's easier for him to get away with things because he can say that, oh, how can I not value black lives when I'm married to a black woman and have black children?
But that's the same thing as saying, how can I be homophobic because I have gay friends, gay best friends.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's like the typical thing that everyone makes fun of. Some of my best friends are black, but it's often used because you're about to say something that's racist.
Yeah.
Did you speak to his wife at all? Or did his wife speak to you or your family at all?
No.
Just Bill de Blasio.
Yeah. He actually sat with my grandfather, my father's stepfather. And, you know, when the indictment came down 3 years ago.
Or lack of indictment, right?
Yeah. You know, they were in the church. And he actually pulled my grandfather aside when my grandfather was so emotional and crying and couldn't believe it, and consoled him, you know, talked with him. So I feel like that's a slap in the face for you to stand 3 years later with police officers on the anniversary opening up a police station. That was like, you know, wow.
Right.
What type of, you know, empathy for our family? You know, that was just like heartbreaking.
So it's like a betrayal.
Yeah.
And what has happened to Pantaleo since then?
He's been getting raises for the past 3 years, more than $100,000. He's still working. And like, that's it. He just got more money and no punishment.
When they announced the decision to not indict Pantaleo, where were you? How did you find out?
Well, my family members gathered at the National Action Network.
Al Sharpton's organization?
Yeah, Al Sharpton's organization. He got a House of Justice in Harlem. So all my siblings and family members met there to hear the decision. And we was all sitting around, and most of my family members was crying and stuff. I was just angry.
And were you surprised by the non-indictment?
I was kind of prepared because just a week before, Mike Brown from Ferguson, who got gunned down by a police officer, that DA in that case, you know, made his decision and announced it to the world.
Right.
And that tore me up and kind of prepared me. And when I left to come back to Waynesburg, where I live, the Waynesburg Bridge was blocked off because of all the protesters that was out in the streets that night. And I made the cab driver stop. And I got out the car and I told everyone that I appreciate their support. I'm his daughter. And everyone started screaming, you know, this is Eric Garner's daughter, you know, random hugs, random words of kindness. And I asked them, you know, can they clear away? Because I got to get home, but I appreciate it. I asked them, can they clear the road? Because, you know, they were blocking and I needed to get home across the Waynesburg Bridge.
And how did it feel when you saw that?
It was very, like, empowering. It was like, you know, at the saddest moment in my life where I was just, you know, in this cab ride just waiting to get home, mine just in shock and just seeing all these people showing their support and out there in the cold, I was like, you know, it was overwhelming. But it was also empowering.
Do you remember, like, how you realized what was happening? Did you know because you saw a particular sign, or did it take you a while to figure out what it was?
No, I knew because of the chants. You know, they were screaming, I Can't Breathe, you know, Eric Garner. I seen I Can't Breathe shirts, I Can't Breathe, you know, posters. So I knew they was out there for my dad.
And another thing is that de Blasio refuses to make the chokehold illegal.
Yes. He has stated that, you know, there's no need to make it a law because it's already in the guidelines of the police policies. But the reason why it became a police policy is because of something that happened in the 90s with a kid who got choked by an officer. He was playing football on the street and the altercation happened and he ended up killing the little boy, choking him out. So they made it a policy, but I believe that it should be a law, that it should be criminal.
People want to criminalize it.
Yes.
There's an attempt to make chokeholds, which is defined as a move that cuts off air or blood flow through the neck, make that a misdemeanor, punishable by prison or a fine or both. And de Blasio is saying that he would veto it.
Yes.
De Blasio's spokesperson said, as is consistent with his previously stated views on the issue, the mayor would veto the chokehold bill as it is currently drafted were it to reach his desk. They're saying it's unnecessary since it's already against police policy to do it. But clearly that's not a significant deterrent, right? Because Pantaleo did it. Obviously, something that stops people from doing things is when they're going to have to pay for the crime by paying a fine or going to jail.
Yeah.
Were you surprised that he didn't get behind criminalizing chokeholds?
I believe that he's blocking any type of justice my family is seeking towards having some type of closure in my father's case. Whether it's the chokehold bill, the Right to Know Act, even the recommendation from the Civilian Complaint Review Board.
They recommended that Daniel Pantaleo's records be released, and de Blasio has also refused to do that.
Yes, although that unknown source from the CCRB leaked the information.
And the person who leaked the documents resigned.
I got to see them. In my father's case, everything was substantiated, but still, you know, Bill de Blasio chooses not to do anything. I also filed a Freedom of Information Act right around my father's death. The response I got was that I would have to ask Pantaleo personally to review his records. And then I think a couple of weeks after the leaked information, I got another letter in the mail from the city stating that the CCRB, that they found the chokehold was substantiated when they constructed his breathing. And also, Pantaleo had previous complaints against him that was substantiated, and still nothing has been done.
Right. So reading a report at Think Progress, it says that the documents, which were obtained by Think Progress, show that Pantaleo, who was still is still employed by the NYPD, had a history of breaking the rules, and that he had 7 disciplinary complaints and 14 individual allegations lodged against him. 4 of those allegations were substantiated by an independent review board. Documents show that Pantaleo refused to seek medical treatment for someone in 2009, hit someone against an inanimate object in 2011, made abusive vehicular stops and searches on 2 separate occasions in 2012, and used physical force during another incident in 2013. So again, this is kind of a, you know, we people like to pretend that something like the killing of your father is an isolated incident or it's one bad apple. But the blood isn't just on the hands of Pantaleo. It's on the hands of the entire police force as an institution and the higher ups. Because how can you have someone who's already had complaints against him have the power of arrest and be armed with a gun or a nightstick? With which he then kills a man in a chokehold.
Yes, and also the 120th precinct on Staten Island, a lot of police officers or detectives, you know, has a lot of lawsuits or complaints filed against them. So I feel like the whole precinct, not only the whole precinct, but going up from the sergeant to the police, all the way up to the police commissioner, I feel like it's a cover-up.
Right.
I think we should start from the bottom all the way to the top, because it's not just blaming one person. There's a lot of people involved with covering up my dad's murder. Like the police report that was filed right after my father's death was false allegations. You know, it was stated in there that, you know, he could breathe and he didn't complain of not being able to breathe. And clearly on the video, you can hear him say, you know, I can't breathe.
Multiple times, yeah.
Yeah. And also the 2 guys or 3 guys that were strip searched in the middle of the street, they ended up settling out of court, but also they part of Pantaleo's past.
You'd think that people who are fiscal conservatives and want to save money, they would want some kind of system put in place so that the city isn't constantly paying out lawsuits.
Yes, and a lot of people think that lawsuits equal justice, and it don't. But I believe that's just a way of the city saying, here's some money, now shut up.
You got a settlement, and I think that some people who are apologists for the police try to delegitimize you and your family by saying, you know, you just wanted the money or something, which is absurd because you have been fighting since the settlement.
Yes.
It's not like you stopped or shut up.
No, and I will not. You know, money doesn't amount to the life that was lost. You know, a lot of people think, oh, we won the lottery or we didn't get to heaven or whatever the case may be. But in my case and how I feel, like no amount of money can, you know, amount to the times lost with my father and his grandchildren. Also, this money is to help towards the movement, help towards, you know, finding some type of answers. So it is a help, but it's not a solution.
So how is it a help? Can you elaborate on what you mean when you say it's to help find answers and help the movement?
Help as far as, you know, going out and trying to build an organization and, you know, speak with lawyers or just trying to, like, the expenses. Like, if I need to get on a plane and go to another state to lobby against, you know, this person, or go to Washington, D.C., and stuff like that.
Right. Pantaleo gets all the services that you get when you're still a policeman.
Yeah.
All the coverage, like the health insurance, all that. But if you or your family needed, like, trauma counseling because he killed your family member, you would have to pay for that, obviously.
Yeah. I seeked help. Because I was angry and I was dealing with a lot and I didn't know how to deal with my grief. In the Black community, a lot of Black people don't seek the help that they need as far as mental services, mental health. And I tried to sit down with a therapist, and the cost is like $300 an hour just to sit down and talk to someone. So that's another obstacle we have to face when stuff like this happens. This is why I believe there should be more organizations out there offering this help and making this a part of the health insurance. Like, our health insurance should be, you know, covered by that.
You mean like there should be in this country or state or city health care provided, or do you mean people in your situation should have more support?
I'm saying as a whole.
Right.
Because, you know, our community needs it, but especially for the people who's dealing with this type of trauma. We shouldn't have to pay for counseling sessions. Police officers are covered by that.
I mean, yeah, it should come out from the police department should be forced to pay for that, if anything.
Yeah, if anything, yes.
Yeah, I think this people don't realize how bad de Blasio has been on this issue, because I think because the police are so bad to him, people kind of assume he must be doing the right thing. But there's a lot of room between doing the right thing and having the police mad at you.
Yeah, but, you know, the way that I see it, like, you know, what's more important, a mad police officer or doing the right thing?
Oh, of course, right. No, I'm just saying it's ironic that, like, in other words, the police are so spoiled and so entitled and have so much impunity, and there's so little accountability for the police that even someone who doesn't pursue them or doesn't go after them, they still turn their backs on him. But it's just enough to even speak out and say that police brutality is wrong, even if you're not putting in policies in place. Like, even lip service to victims of police brutality is too much for the police to be able to handle without turning their backs or threatening a slowdown, which I always thought was kind of ironic, because probably a lot of the people who are protesting the police would be happy if they were slowing down their work.
Yeah.
And Cuomo?
He promised the families of police brutality. I started a group called the Mothers of the Movement. And these are like mothers who lost children of from police brutality. They met up with him to sign an executive order to have a special prosecutor with these cases, taking it out of the local DA's hands. And he signed the order with the promise of keep renewing them every year until Congress or what have you makes it permanent. But it only lasted a year, and he hasn't renewed it. He never kept his word.
The special prosecutor mandate?
Yes.
What is left to be done in terms of the civil rights portion by the end of the year? You said the Justice Department promised to bring resolution to the status of the civil rights portion by the end of the year. So what can people do?
Keep urging them to come down with a decision. They did promise, you know, they would have a decision by the end of the year. Me and my family haven't heard anything. So I'm hoping that we keep it out there to put pressure on them to finally try to seek the answer that we deserve.
Can I ask how old you are?
27.
Okay, so, and how old were you when your father was killed?
I was 23.
And when was the last time you saw your father? Do you remember the last interaction you had with him?
Father's Day. I usually have get-togethers in the summertime, you know, a big barbecue, and it was Father's Day. I was celebrating Father's Day with him, with family. And I just remember him spending the day with his granddaughters on the swing. He even wanted, you know, his food brought to him.
At the swing?
By the swing. Just sat there and bonded with his two granddaughters.
So it was a nice memory?
Yes. Like, he was a family man. Like, all the holidays, any type of events, he was always there. He always made sure, you know, he supported any way he can.
Yeah. That's nice, yeah. He seemed like, like you called him a gentle giant, right?
Yeah, a gentle giant. He was so, like, as far as, like, arguments go, you know, you wouldn't hear a peep out of him. As long as his kids is happy, he was happy.
Yeah. But it's just so ironic that here it's like the police are supposed to be maintaining order and safety, and your father was killed right after he had helped break up a fight.
Yeah.
And then he gets arrested right after that, and, you know, they pretend it was, the irony again is that he he had had in the past sold loose cigarettes, Lucy's, but he hadn't that day. And so you hear him on the video, and there are two videos. One is by Ramsey Orta, and one is by a woman, Tanisha Allen, that was released after. And that shows how they just, it didn't give him any medical attention, just left him on the ground. But in the Ramsey Orta footage, we see him say, like, this stops today, like, stop harassing me. What did I do? I didn't do anything. And they were just waiting for him. You know, they didn't even care if they caught him doing something that they could arrest him for. They just literally went after him.
Yeah. In Matt Taibbi's book, he interviewed someone from the police side, and basically it was an order, you know, coming up from the higher ups saying that my father was a problem and, you know, they needed to get him by any means necessary.
Right.
So it wasn't really about him being arrested for cigarettes, or they just wanted him gone, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just like I said, it starts all the way from the bottom to all the way to the top.
Right.
You know, you just can't blame one person. It's just in a hole.
Right. I mean, it starts at the top, right? It goes all the way to the bottom. But in terms of, like, where it actually originates, it's the people at the top calling the shots. Mm-hmm. But they never get in trouble.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's true. Actually, one of the great things about that book, about the book, I Can't Breathe by Matt Taibbi, is he goes through the kind of, it's not just a random altercation on the street where they're angry. It's that, like, their actual, you know, rules and orders and quotas that they have to fulfill. And he talks about how it has to do with gentrification also, and they're building, like, luxury housing now on Staten Island, so they're cleaning up, quote-unquote, cleaning up areas.
Yeah, and basically what he put it as, like, why would someone from Wall Street come to Staten Island, you know, got this beautiful apartment and looking over the Hudson River, just to have someone like an Eric Garner outside their house? So it was more like property. Just like in Ferguson, when, you know, a lot of people made it a big deal about businesses being burnt down and whatnot. You know, it wasn't about the money. It was mostly about getting the message that we don't care about, you know, these businesses or the money you can make off of it. We care about the broken necks and people dying.
Right, like in Baltimore with Freddie Gray, right?
Yes.
And, like, the biggest, yeah, they didn't, no one really cared about, like, the media cared more about the CVS than Freddie Gray dying, yeah, being killed.
And, you know, in Baltimore, you know, it's like a Mason-Dixon line. Like, on one side of Baltimore, it's all nice with pretty houses, and then on another side, it's like the slum, like a lot of abandoned buildings, a lot of homeless people, a lot of, you know, stores being boarded up or gated. I actually went out there and I couldn't even find a McDonald's, you know, to go get lunch.
Mm-hmm.
Things were just so bad.
Wow.
And these are conditions that was there before the burning of houses or whatever.
Oh, before the uprising?
Yeah, before the uprising.
Which, of course, people, I mean, politically will call a riot, but other people call it, you know. It's a riot when they're black people, but when it's, like, white people about pumpkin fest, whatever, that, you know, that story. There were some,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, it's like, you know, when a football game happened and, yeah, a lot of white people, you know, get drunk and destroy cars or whatever. It's just, you know, people expressing themselves.
Right.
Like, it's black people, it's a riot.
Right. And did you meet any of the family members and of, like, did you meet, like, Sean Bell's family or Anthony Baez's family in New York? Or did you meet Michael Brown's family or Trayvon Martin's family? Any
yes,
working with them?
Like I said, I created a Mothers of the Movement, kind of like a group. You know, it's with my grandmother, Trayvon Martin's mom, Michael Brown's mom, Sean Bell's mom, Freddie Gray's mom, Tamir Rice's mom.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, it's like, you know, we need all of them to stand together.
Right.
You know, to share each other's pain and keep keep each console each other and help push for the message we're trying to get out there. I met with them. I done talked with them, you know. Even got some advice from Trayvon Martin's mom.
What kind of advice?
Just about how she's been, you know, fighting for her son for years, and even though Zimmerman haven't been indicted or whatever, she still pushed forward, and she started her own, you know, foundation. And basically what she do is called a Mother's Circle of Healing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's every year she gets the mothers together who lost, you know, children. And they just have like a spa day or something and a whole bunch of workshops.
Oh, nice. And so does it give you some solace or consolation to be around other people who've gone through this?
Yes. And I think by me being this outspoken person, I think it encourages them to keep fighting also.
Yeah. How much of that do you feel like you got from your father, if any?
A lot.
Yeah.
Because if he was alive today, he would be doing the same thing. Like, if he was able to survive what happened to him,
right,
he would be out here advocating and, you know, doing exactly what I'm doing, if not more.
And did he do any of that in his life around other issues? Or, I mean, I know he helped a lot of people. Like, you talk about how there was a homeless person was it in Staten Island or in Brooklyn where he lived?
It was in Staten Island.
Who was very upset and who mentioned that your dad would buy him food and sneakers and stuff. Or get him sneakers and stuff. But so he was kind of an activist that way. But did he do other kinds of activism?
He researched the law a lot.
Oh, nice.
You know, he studied what the cops was doing to him and was pointed out, like, you know, this is what he's doing. I mean, they're doing wrong. And he actually, you know, did go about it the right way. He did put in complaints about the 120th precinct on Staten Island, and he actually was starting to get, like, around his death, he was actually starting to get responses.
Mm.
And I believe, like, that's why Pantaleo or other officers had some type of animosity towards him,
right,
because he had a couple of officers transferred out of that.
Wow.
Out of that precinct.
Wow. Do you remember what it was for, or?
I believe it was for being wrongfully arrested, and he was strip searched one time, and I would say molested in the street,
because right,
a guy, a police officer, you know, played with his genitals, he put it.
Right.
My father had an open case right before he passed away. He was screaming that he just wanted his money back. He didn't care about, you know, going to jail, but they refused to release some his money that he had on him one of the days that he got locked up.
Oh, so he had money on him and they confiscated it?
Yeah, they wouldn't give him back, you know, once he paid his bill or whatever.
Oh, okay.
You know, they wouldn't give him back his money, and he was, you know, saying, you know, I don't mind going to jail, but just give me my money so I can give it to my wife and kids,
right,
before I go to jail.
And so they still hadn't done that at that point?
No.
Did you ever get it back?
I tried looking into it, but they saying, being that I'm not the person who actually did the complaint or whatever,
right,
and being that it's so old, well, not so old, but, you know, whatever happened to my father, basically, it just doesn't matter now.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
But I did try to continue on that case or whatever he was fighting.
And were you ever afraid that you would face some kind of retaliation? Because as we know, like, Ramsey Orta was kind of targeted by police, and he reported that he was beat up and put in solitary. So were you ever afraid of that?
Yes and no, but, you know, I believe that a couple of my family members, anytime, like, my last name or my father's last name, anybody connected with my family, you know, gets harassed by the police or, you know, they make it a big deal. Like my cousin, she was just arrested not too long ago, and they was more focused on mentioning my name and my father's name than actually what she was there for.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, it's like a gift and a curse, you know, say?
Yeah.
Like my activism and getting my voice out there, but I also have to keep, you know, I guess an eye open for like officers.
Right.
But as I was doing my protests, I also faced, you know, little things. Like there was a counter protest on the same route on the same day sometimes, a police officer, you know, protesting saying Blue Lives Matter.
Right.
The baseball field on Staten Island, you know, did an event for Blue Lives Matter. And I thought that was like kind of a slap in the face because it just, and like my father was killed just a block away from it, like walking distance. And also like where I would protest, you know, cops would set up barricades, you know, to try to make it seem like my protest wasn't going to happen or they was going to interfere or something like that.
Right.
I still did it anyway.
Thank you so much. This was great. And I really appreciate it, especially because I know you have a 3-month-old. Does your daughter like her younger brother, or has she tried to kill him or anything?
No.
Okay.
She loves him, and she's a great help.
Oh, nice. Great. Yeah.
But thank you.
Yeah, and, thanks so much. And have a great weekend.
You too.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial. If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.